Okay, so we will get going right now. Brendan, can you tell me about the golden age of skyjacking?
Yeah, sure. So from 1961 to the end of 1972, there were actually 159 hijackings in American airspace. Most of those, about 130 of them, took place between 68 and the end of 72, often at a pace of more than one a week, sometimes more than one per day. So it was really a common thing, an almost everyday thing for stretches there.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to fathom right now, and that hijacking to us is so terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know...
Yeah. Sorry, I was going to
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say it was almost... No, I'm sorry. It was kind of like a virus almost, or what we call a meme these days, an idea that would spread via the media from one person to another. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. I think the epidemic model is really useful in thinking about this period. Certainly, you had clusters of incidents where you'd have hijackers imitating one another in terms of their modus operandi or the locations they would hit or their demands. Then you'd have some kind of official response to it, or people would see these hijackers punished quite severely, and there'd be a drop-off, and all of a sudden you'd have another outbreak, just like an epidemic, another clustering of cases.
Mm-hmm. And the media was all over these, right? Like, the media loved to cover these.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there was something very photogenic and telegenic. This was kind of at the dawn of local news being a powerhouse, you know, eyewitness news. They bring their cameras out to the airports and they would, film the ransom money being delivered to the plane, or they'd film the negotiators out on the tarmac. So there was a real telegenic quality to this crime.
Mm-hmm. So who were these skyjackers? Did they have anything in common?
This was a real challenge when I was researching it because they all came from very different backgrounds. They all had very different stated motives. You had disgruntled veterans. You had people with political reasons. You had the mentally unstable. You had pure criminals. It was very hard to draw a common thread between them all. But the more I looked at it, I realized that these were all people who were very desperate, who had been kind of cornered by circumstance and felt they could only do one thing to change their lives radically in one fell swoop. And that was hijack a plane.
Hmm. So that was the primary motivation for these people? They were desperate?
Certainly, if you scratch me at the surface, you know, if you ask them, they would often state political motives, or they would state, you know, financial motives, or there might be some kind of personal grievance they have. But it really came down to things had not gone well in their lives.
Hmm.
Often they were traumatized by things that happened in their past. Romances had gone awry. Businesses had failed. They'd had a hard time getting employment. And they really saw this, you know, having seen others do it, they saw it as a way to dramatically and radically alter the course of their lives in one day.
Mm. Even though not many hijackers were actually successful, were they? Like, they usually didn't get away. They'd make the trip. Mm-hmm. They'd get to take the plane where they wanted to, but they often wouldn't end up holding on to the ransom money they demanded, would they?
Yeah, not a lot of happy endings for the hijackers, actually. Certainly the ones who asked for a ransom, which is what happened at the end of this epidemic, this decade-long epidemic. The ransom almost always went back to the airline, either seized by a foreign government or they would arrest the person after they jumped out of the plane and find the money. You often had a lot of people who made it to foreign countries and would spend some time, say, in Cuba or Algeria.
Mm-hmm.
But those people often came back after a year or two because of their lives there were not what they imagined. They kind of imagined these heroic and comfortable lives in these foreign countries. And in fact, they were very hard, and many of them were imprisoned upon arriving in these places. So you had a lot who came back. There are still a few who continue to this day to live in exile, specifically in Havana, and a few in Paris as well. And they cannot come back. They'll be prosecuted.
Hmm. And nearly all of the skyjackers asked to go to Cuba. Why did they want to go there?
Yeah, it's really interesting. This was the longest and really first phase of the hijacking epidemic. And this was, as you say, people wanted to go to Havana. This was shortly after the Cuban Revolution. So I think people didn't quite know what to make of what Cuba would become. And I think there was a lot of belief that Castro really was establishing this kind of classless workers' paradise down there. And a lot of people idolized him and really believed that, you know, there was something promising and different down there. And when they got there, of course, the reality was quite the opposite. In fact, Castro wanted nothing to do with these American hijackers. He was very suspicious of them, thinking they might be CIA operatives.
Mm.
And he imprisoned many of them.
Hmm. Wow. And what did the American public think of these hijackers? Could they relate to them in some way?
Yeah, this was really interesting to me in that at first, and really for the majority of this epidemic, the American public didn't take it all that seriously. I think on one level, as you say, that there was a lot of chaos and dissension in American society at that point over the war, over a lot of generational transitions that were going on, the tail end of the baby boom, the youth culture that was coming up, and the civil rights movement. And there was a lot of real anger and rage directed at the establishment in America. So I think people did perhaps have some sympathy for those who felt so excluded from the American dream that they felt, you know, ready to lash out in this manner. I think the other part of it is because there were really not a lot of death and destruction that was involved, at least at first. Mm-hmm. You know, the airlines would fly the people down to Havana or wherever they wanted to go, and the other passengers didn't really think that they would be harmed in the middle of this. They thought, well, I'll spend a night in a hotel in Havana and buy some cigars and rum and come back and tell a great story at dinner parties.
And that's usually and what happened. That usually was the case, right? They were pretty much
always
right about
that. Well,
that
was certainly the case for the beginning and even the middle of the epidemic. And it's really when things got crazy and people started dying is when there was a need to take action. And the American public's view of the hijackers really changed at that point once the bullets started flying.
Yeah, yeah. There was one Italian named Raphael Minichiello.
Minichiello, yes.
Minichiello, can you tell me about him? He kind of made the hijacking history, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a fascinating figure. So he was an Italian-born American Marine who had fought in Vietnam and actually earned a Purple Heart. And he had a pay dispute with the Marines upon coming back to the U.S. He believed they'd shorted him $200 in back pay. And so one night he got drunk and broke into his post exchange and stole $200 worth of watches, thinking that this is what the Marines owed him, so it was justified. And when he was court-martialed for this, kind of in a rage, he hijacked a plane flying out of Los Angeles. And he actually asked to be flown to his native Italy. He was the first hijacker. This was November 69. The first hijacker to ask to be flown somewhere other than Cuba. And the airline actually complied with his request and flew him to Rome via JFK Airport here in New York and then Bangor, Maine and Shannon, Ireland. And in Rome, he actually was greeted as a folk hero and a sex symbol as well. And the Italians refused to extradite him to the U.S. And in his eventual trial, he was only given an 18-month sentence.
Wow.
And actually still lives in Italy to this day, actually, in his native village.
And is he still held in high acclaim, high esteem, still considered a hero?
He's somewhat of a forgotten figure, actually.
Yeah.
There's been some follow-up on his case after the book has come out. So I think there is a certain reverence for him, and he definitely tugs at a certain spirit in the Italian character, I think. You have to think this was a time in history when the Italian public and much of the European public was very much opposed to the Vietnam War. And so he really symbolized the opposition to that war for many people in Italy.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it was surprisingly easy to hijack a plane back at this time compared to what we have to endure these days. Airport security was very lax back then, maybe even non-existent, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think non-existence really, really the operative phrase. It's hard to fathom, as you say now, the gauntlet we have to deal with getting on planes today. But, you know, back in the late 60s, you could literally walk from the curbside outside the terminal, through the terminal, onto the tarmac, to the top of the boarding stairs, and sometimes even onto the plane without having a ticket, without showing anyone identification, certainly without having anyone check your luggage or your body. So it was very, very easy for hijackers to bring weapons onto planes.
Mm-hmm. So the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, created the Special Anti-Hijacking Task Force to come up with possible solutions. And the task force received thousands of letters from citizens with their own ideas. What kinds of things did the people suggest?
A lot of them are pretty off the wall. A lot of them had to do with, you know, arming stewardesses with tranquilizer darts.
Oh, boy.
Putting trap doors outside cockpits, to then trapping the hijackers in plexiglass cages in the hold of the aircraft. A few of the more outlandish ones. There's one person who suggested making all the passengers wear boxing gloves, and that way you can't hold onto a gun if you have a boxing gloves on your hand. Or playing the Cuban national anthem before takeoff, and then if anyone knows the lyrics, don't arrest them immediately.
Mm-hmm, but that presumes, of course, that any Cubans on the plane or people familiar with the Cuban national anthem be savvy enough to refrain from singing along. Yeah, wow.
Not the most ingenious idea. The one that was taken quite seriously by the FAA actually was to build a fake Havana airport in a field in South Florida. And so what you do is you would fly the the hijackers kind of out over the water, then make a sharp right turn and go back to Florida and land and say, hey, congratulations, you made it to Cuba, and then it arrest the hijackers getting off the plane. And that was actually dismissed as being too expensive.
Mm. But it was actually considered seriously.
It was actually considered quite seriously. Wow. Yeah.
Sort of a Disneyland approach. The airport is theme park. Mm.
Yes.
What security measures did the American government implement to try to prevent or reduce the hijacking of planes?
Well, so prior to, you know, searching people, they wanted to come up with something that was very non-invasive. They wanted something that the airlines would accept and not rebel with their lobbyists over on Capitol Hill. So they came up with this behavioral profile. It's basically a checklist of 25 behavioral cues that are supposed to indicate if someone might be a hijacker. These are things like not maintaining appropriate eye contact, not knowing enough about your luggage or caring about your luggage. Wearing army surplus gear was one of them. And what they did is they trained ticket agents to know these tip-offs. And then it was responsibility of the ticket agents to give passengers the once over when selling them a ticket or giving them a boarding pass. And then if someone fit one of these characteristics, then that person could be beckoned aside and briefly searched physically by a security officer. And it was supposed to apply to about half of 1% of all travelers.
Hmm. Was it effective? Did it work?
It was not effective at all, actually. And there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one is that I think the jury's really out on how indicative these behaviors are of hijackers. Many times people were screened and passed with flying colors and were not searched and turned out to hijack the plane. The other problem with it is that, you know, having ticket agents do this, ticket agents are overwhelmed as it is.
Yeah.
And they're dealing with hundreds upon hundreds of harried, somewhat sometimes verbally abusive customers every day. And for them to add on security agent on top of this, to someone who's really not trained in that, it's not a very reliable way of making safer flying.
Yeah. How many people died as a result of airplane hijackings? Can you put a number on it?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it wasn't really that many. I mean, you certainly had some hijackers who were killed. Most of the casualties were hijackers. Mm. Hijackers, especially in 71 and 72, you had hijackers being shot by FBI snipers and by authorities. The authorities became quite aggressive. You had some pilots killed, specifically one in an incident by Boston who was shot by a hijacker. Mm. You had some passengers killed by hijackers. There was an incident in Chicago where a hijacker came on and when he's at the top of the boarding stairs, shot a man who may have just been coming back to hang up his coat. And you actually had some passengers accidentally killed and wounded by the FBI during gun battles on planes when they took an ambush strategy. There was a notable incident in San Francisco in July of 72 where the FBI stormed the plane and had a shootout with two hijackers and one passenger was killed, and I believe three were injured quite badly, including the actor who played the cook on Bonanza.
Oh, wow. Hmm. You focus much of your attention on Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow. Can you tell me about them?
Yeah, sure. So Roger Holder was a Vietnam veteran. He'd served in the Army. He'd actually done four tours. And at the tail end of his time in Vietnam, he had been arrested for smoking marijuana in Saigon and had become really irate over his punishment over this. He was sent to the stockade for a while and then demoted in rank and had a clash with his commanding officer, was sent back to the U.S. as punishment and then went AWOL and was living in San Diego where his family was living. His dad was in the Navy, and he meets this young woman, Kathy Kirkow, from a small town in Oregon called Coos Bay, and she's working in a massage parlor in San Diego. And they meet and they fall in love and they become infatuated with one another. And at the same time, Roger's plotting something to do with his life that will make clear his feelings about the way he'd been treated by the Army and some certain rage that had been boiling up inside of him over some childhood issues as well. And he decides he wants to hijack a plane to liberate the imprisoned black radical Angela Davis, who was then on trial in a murder conspiracy trial in San Jose, California. And so he decides he wants to hijack a plane, exchange the passengers for Angela Davis and about $3 million in cash, and take both the cash and Miss Davis to North Vietnam, where he would hope that Miss Davis would be given asylum and he could donate the cash to the Viet Cong as a sign of atonement for his involvement in the war. And he decided he wanted his girlfriend, Kathy Kirkow, to come with him and do this.
Hmm. And they had actually met before, right? They had met as children in Coos Bay.
Is that
right? This is what's really interesting. Yeah. So, Sir Roger, like I said, his dad was in the Navy, and he's an African-American family. And in 1958, I believe it was, his family is posted to the Coos Head Naval Station, which had opened there recently, a radar station off the coast. And they were really about the only black family in town. And his family was treated quite harshly, in fact, by many local residents. And Roger Holder's younger brother was beaten quite badly at school. And so they were forced to leave town. And in the days running up to their departure from Coos Bay, actually, Roger Holder and Kathy Kirk had a very brief encounter at a recreational area. I believe he was about 10, she was about 8 at the time.
So how did Holder and Kirko hijack a plane? What did they do?
Well, Roger Holder, when the plane was en route from Los Angeles to Seattle, and about 25 minutes before touchdown in Seattle, Roger Holder went to the rear of the plane. It's a Western Airlines Boeing 727 jet, and he handed the stewardess two notes, one saying that, you know, this was a hijacking and that he was affiliated with the Weathermen, the radical organization. Mm-hmm. And another note that was a diagram of a briefcase that showed a bomb inside a briefcase. And in fact, he was holding just such a briefcase with a length of copper wire with a ring on it that was around his finger.
Did it really have a bomb in it?
It did not really have a bomb in it, no.
Okay. Yeah. So then and then he demands, he wanted to be flown to North Vietnam, right? He wanted that.
He did, yep.
Yeah.
He wanted Angela Davis. He wanted $3 million in cash, and he wanted to be flown to North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And then the plan changed, though, right? The change of destination. Originally, it was North Vietnam, but then he didn't end up wanting to be flied there. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, there was one big error that he made. He hijacked the wrong kind of plane. A Boeing 727 is a very short-range aircraft, and certainly can really not get to Hawaii, let alone to North Vietnam, even with refueling stops. And so he needed a new plane. And actually had to request a new plane, part of his ransom demands for the passengers. And the second complication was that Angela Davis wanted nothing to do with this plot. When she was informed of this, it was actually the day that her case had gone to the jury in San Jose. And the plane had flown to San Francisco to hopefully pick her up, and she absolutely refused to get on this plane, even to converse with the hijacker. She wanted nothing to do with this whatsoever.
Okay. So what happened to Holder and Kirko when they landed in Algeria?
Yeah, so they decide, they do get their new plane. They get a Boeing 720, which is a long-range jet. And but because of all the complications that had ensued during the hijacking, Roger Holder decides that he wants to shift the plan and fly to Algeria, as you said. They fly through JFK Airport at New York, and they fly direct to Algiers. And in Algiers, the reason that Roger Holder picked that was pretty interesting. At that time, there was a small Black Panther commune led by Eldridge Cleaver, the exiled Minister of Information for the Panthers, and notably the author of Soul on Ice. He was had fled the U.S. after being charged with attempted murder over an incident, a shootout that had occurred in the Bay Area, and was living there with a small group of followers and as well as his family. And Roger wanted to join that commune. It's called the International Section of the Black Panther Party. And in fact, the Algerians at that time were a very anti-American regime, I think some similarities to Venezuela today. And they gave him and Kathy Kirko a political asylum there and let him crash with the Panthers in Algiers.
But they didn't. Did Kirko and Holder get to hold on to the money?
They did not get to hold on to the money. The Algerian government seized the money and actually arranged for it to be returned to Western Airlines. It's interesting. When they handed back the sack of cash, Western Airlines counted it, and it was they'd ultimately given them $500,000, Holder and Kirko, and they counted the money that was returned, only $488,000. So someone had stuck their hand in the bag at some point and taken out 12 grand, but the airline did not complain about that.
And didn't Holder also leave a tip for the flight crew?
He did, yeah. He put $5,000 in the oven in the aft galley because he felt that they treated him in a gentlemanly manner. He felt they deserved a little something else. But of course, the pilots returned that immediately to the airline.
So this isn't the end of the story, though. How long did Holder and Kirko stay in Algeria?
They stayed there for about a year, a little over a year. And, you know, at this time, the commune was kind of falling apart. There was a lot of disputes between Eldridge Cleaver and the Algerian government over money and some other matters. The Algerian government felt that he embarrassed them publicly in a political statement that he made to the Algerian press. And eventually the commune fell apart and people scattered all over. You had some people going to places like Tanzania and Egypt, and the Cleavers went to Paris. And that's actually eventually where Holder and Kirko went as well.
Hmm. And did they ever stand trial for the skyjacking?
Well, it's a complicated question.
Yeah.
They were, and I don't want to give away too much about the book.
Okay.
I will say that they were arrested in Paris eventually,
okay.
And the French did refuse to extradite them to the U.S. They saw the hijacking as a purely political act in opposition to the Vietnam War. And, you know, there's an exception to extradition treaties in that if, you know, you feel that someone's going to be persecuted for their political beliefs if they're returned to a country, you can deny an extradition request. And that's exactly what happened in the case of Holder and Kirko. The French did resolve to try Holder and Kirko themselves. And that actually is wrapped up a little bit in the end of the book.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask, well, I can ask you and we'll find out if you'll answer me. Can I, where are Roger Holder and Kathy Kirko now?
That's really the big question. I'll say that I met with one of them,
mm-hmm.
Who was interviewed at great length for the book.
Can I ask you about that? Can I ask you which one, and can you tell me and what he or she said told you?
I'll say it was Roger Holder. I met with mm-hmm. Roger Holder at great length, and I go into our conversations quite a bit in the book.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the book and my experiences with him. But I found him living in California, actually.
Mm.
He was in his early 60s. And, you know, he had been trying, I think, to tell the story for quite some time and trying to organize his thoughts about the role he played in history and kind of the a lot of the craziness that had happened in his life as a result of some of the choices he'd made, you know, certainly this hijacking and some other choices he'd made in his life. So that was a extremely illuminating part of my research to spend time with him.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this, and I suspect you probably won't want to answer, but I'll only find out if I ask. What's your best guess about where Kathy Kirko is now?
I have a pretty good idea where she is. I discuss a little bit in my book, but
mm-hmm.
I think that all the evidence probably points to her having resettled and melded into either French or Swiss society. She had connections in those places. And I discuss, you know, a little bit about mm-hmm. what I found out about her fate in the book.
Mm-hmm. Are you continuing to pursue? Like, are you trying to track down and where exactly she is and possibly write about that? Or
I am. And in fact, the book was recently published in a French translation, and I'm planning to try to use some of the intelligence I gather from people who read it to perhaps get some new leads. And I'm still talking to people in that part of the world, so I'm hoping to get some more clarity on her fate.
Okay, that would be interesting to find out. So, Brendan, with all of the heightened air security, I'm sorry, wrong question. I'm screwing that one. Okay. So, Brendan, has writing The Skies Belong to Us changed the way you think about flying? Are you more patient with the whole airport security experience now?
I think to some extent. I think that, you know, I certainly understand how vulnerable airplanes are and how much chaos you can wreak if you do commandeer a plane. By the same token, I think that, you know, I'm a big believer that we've tipped over into security theater,
mm-hmm.
as the phrase goes,
yeah.
for a lot of what goes on at checkpoints. And, you know, I think that there's perspective from both sides of the coin to be gained from how we dealt with the golden age of hijacking. You know, a lot of it came down to if you do smart things and take meaningful measures that are really going to make a difference. You don't need a lot of the fluff, the inconvenient fluff that circulates around it, you know. So I think that we need to step back a little bit and really analyze, you know, what are we doing that's keeping us safe and what are we doing that's giving us the illusion of safety?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, one thing I wanted to go back to ask you about during the actual mm-hmm. hijacking. I got to set it up in a question in case I want to put it in there. Let me see. What was it? Okay. During the hijacking, Holder made what could easily have been a fatal mistake that could have turned the hijacking, made the hijacking unsuccessful, a failure, right? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so, you know, he had this briefcase with him, and one thing he was doing throughout the hijacking was he was smoking a lot of pot. He brought a whole bunch of joints with him, and he basically, once he had command of the aircraft, pretty much smoked at will. And I think by the, you know, deep into it, he was getting a little burnt out, and actually once when he went to use the laboratory, just left his briefcase that contained his alleged bomb by his seat. And Kathy Kirka was there, and she was sleeping. And so the pilots actually discussed, one of them proposed, do we wait outside the laboratory and hit him over the head and try to take him prisoner and end the hijacking? And actually, the captain overruled that because he didn't know what might happen if Kathy wakes up and grabs the bomb. And there was some intimations there were other bombs stashed in the plane as well, that Roger Holder had hinted at that. So the captain thought it was too much of a gamble to take any action. And in fact, airline policy dictated that pilots were supposed to do nothing that might put the plane or the crew or passengers in any danger, that the priority was safety above all else. So the captain really hewed to what the official policy was.
Okay. That's great. That was wonderful, Brendan. Oh, and I want to make sure the pronunciation, it's Kirko, not Kirkow, the way I said it the first time, right?
Yes,
Kirko,
exactly.
Saying it. Okay, so that's good to know.